Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Cheese, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to show number 13 of the Voice of Indie Blog podcast. Show 13, and it's Halloween week. Woohoo, spooky. I am your host, Beam Weeks, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Stephen Gies. How you doing tonight, Stephen?
I'm doing all right, Beam. I'm down here in Alabama where we're looking at Hurricane Zeta bearing down on us. They're talking 100-mile-an-hour winds by morning, so as soon as I get off here, I'm going to go outside and batten down everything that I can think of. But while we're on the show today live, we will be monitoring Twitter. So if you want to go on over to Twitter and use the hashtag Fresh Ink Group, you can leave a comment or a question for today's guests or just a question about anything in general, and we'll try to address it live on the air. Now, I want to stress that that's hashtag Fresh Ink Group. Last week, we had a couple of people try to use the handle at Fresh Ink Group, and of course, that didn't work. So make sure you use that hashtag sign. And if you're a certain age like I am, the pound sign or the number sign, now they call it a hashtag sign. That's hashtag Fresh Ink Group.
Yeah, and so all you have to do with that is just type in your tweet, and then at the end of that tweet, throw in hashtag Fresh Ink Group, and guess what? We're going to see it. And if you're not on Twitter, you can give us a call at 516-453-9902. Once again, that is 516-453-9902, and we will take your call on the air.
Great. Now, these podcasts, after we finish them, we're still hoping people will go back and listen in the future. So we're posting them every place that'll let us. You can find them in the Fresh Ink Group channel on YouTube. You can go to freshinkgroup.com and click on the tab called podcasts and find them there. You can go to beamweeks.com and find them. And we're working on getting them up on stephengees.com soon as well.
They're already on stephengees.com.
Oh, well, thank you. This guy's getting stuff done faster than I can keep up with him.
Indubitably. And you can also visit YouTube, find the Fresh Ink Group channel there. Just go to YouTube and type in Fresh Ink Group, and you can view all of our trailers and a few audio short stories as well. So keep that in mind, and if you like what you see and you're not subscribed, please do subscribe. And we put a lot of pretty good content up there on a semi-regular basis.
Now, I just got a text from one of our authors, Tammy Trover, who said that she's trying to call in and it's ringing busy. Do you have any advice for her?
No, I don't. There it is.
Hang up and try. Oh, you see her call?
Area code. Is she area code 303?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, well, we got her on there. So just have her hold on.
Yes.
And when we start taking calls, we'll get to them.
Okay, I'll type back to her. You're in. Hold on. Great.
All right.
See, we're doing everything on the fly, live, just as fast as we can get stuff done here. Now, today, we are welcoming author Verwaine Greenhoe. He's a prolific author of memoirs, fiction, nonfiction, fictionalized nonfiction. He's got some true crime stuff. You think this guy writes it? He writes it all.
Yeah. So, born and raised on a small dairy farm in West Central Michigan, Verwaine Greenhoe learned about life and death at an early age. He was lucky enough to have a loving, caring father who taught him about some of the more intricate ins and outs of living every day. He started writing sample stories at age 6 in about 1959 and has been at it ever since. As a boy, no one ever really taught him how to read. He just could. He used that gift to find a world he might not have been able to experience for another decade or more. He later became a medic, worked in a psych ward of a prison, and spent many years working in emergency rooms as an aide and then a nurse. He moved to Michigan's Upper Peninsula the UP, and is getting settled back into a steady writing habit. And with that, welcome to the show, Verwayne. We are truly excited to have you here.
Proud to have you.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Now, would you care to expand on your bio? Do you have anything more to add? Some little exciting tidbits?
I do. I try to write a little bit every day. I write 6 hours a day. I'm retired.
Wow.
I can do whatever the heck I want to do. So, but I find things, and kind of like Stephen King says, you know, something comes to mind, I'm going, I wonder. And then you go it from there.
Yeah, I do the what if.
It's just, to me, I will be watching a television program, and all of a sudden I'm going, huh, that's an interesting concept. Let's see what we can do with that.
Now, I'm from Michigan, born in Detroit, got my degrees from the University of Michigan, and where I'm from, we call you people Upers, for UP,
exactly.
Upper Peninsula.
And
so,
they call you people trolls.
Trolls.
Because
trolls.
You live under the bridge.
Yeah.
Live under the bridge, yep. So, what's it like being a Uper? You like it up there? How's your weather?
Well, right now, just before I came online, I took my dogs out for a walk so they wouldn't be bugging me. And it's 29 and it's snowing.
Oh, geez.
We've had something like 17 or 18 inches of snow. It's not on the ground right now because it mixes back and forth between snow and rain, snow and rain.
That's so, Michigan.
But you either got to be tough or got to be stupid to live here in the UP.
Yeah. Yeah, we're at 45. I'm in Michigan, for those listeners who don't know. I'm also in Michigan, but I'm a good deal away from where Verwayne is at. He's way north, and I'm way south. So we're sitting at 45 degrees right now, and tomorrow we'll probably be in the 60s. But we spent most of today in the low 50s, 50, 51. But it's basically like almost like two different states, the UP and the Lower Peninsula.
Well, it's mid-70s here in Alabama right now, he gloated.
Oh, shut
but,
up, man.
We do have a hurricane coming. So with climate change, we're expecting Alabama to slide off into the Gulf sometime in the next couple of years.
All right. So, Verwayne, I do know some of your background. I know that you're married. How about you share a little bit of that background with you? I know you're married to your second wife now. So give us a little background on your life there.
Yes, sir. My first wife, we were married 44 years. And then January of 2014, Judy was at work at a hospital, and she was just right about to take a baby from a fresh C-section. And they said she stiffened up and fell over backwards. She'd had a stroke.
Oh, no.
She recovered from that, but she'd been an OB nurse for just shy of 45 years. And within just a couple of months, she ended up having to medically retire. And one thing led to another. Judy developed dementia, Alzheimer's, and Parkinson's. Those are all three diseases, one family, and Judy just began to slide off and away from me. And I wrote a book, I Remember Judy, a love story that I finished. I finished that story 9 days before she died. And she got to read, I was able to read parts of it to her. And that, you know, then she passed away, and that happened at home in my arms, and that sent me spiraling off into my own little level of depression, and things didn't go well for me for a long time, and I questioned why I even wanted to be. Why did I want to continue without this woman in my life, because she was an amazing woman. And then I ran into, actually at the funeral for my wife, I ran into this next girl that I had known her. I met her originally back in 2000, but I hadn't seen her since 2000. And she met me at the funeral, and she came up and told me she was sorry to hear about the loss of my wife. And that began a little tag thing back and forth between Facebook Messenger and back and forth, and then emails. And we finally began to meet. And over the course of the next 18 months, we began to meet, and things begin, you know, how things go, things begin to happen. And I'm 67. My current wife is now just shy of 55. She looks much younger than that. And which always, why I was asking myself, why would this good-looking, intelligent woman want to hang with a moron like me? So I never said anything to anybody. Why would anybody want to hang with a youper? Well, that just began to escalate. And I never said anything to anybody about this. Even my closest friends knew nothing about this right up until, I'm going to say it was late July before any of my friends knew, July of this year, that any of my friends knew that I was dating again. Because it just absolutely, I figured at any moment, she's going to go, well, I've had enough of hanging around with the old guy, so I'm going to go find somebody more my age. Because like I said, there's 13 years between us. But that didn't work. And I ended up writing a book, just like I wrote a book about my wife. I wrote a book about my relationship with this girl. It's called Finding Myself Again. Because I literally was at the end of my rope. I had literally began to conceive and think about doing stupid things. Loneliness does that to you. So, I couldn't help it. I'm sitting up here all by myself, just me and my three dogs. Nobody in their right mind comes up here. So, because in the summer you got the black flies, in the winter you got all that bloody snow. So,
man, the black flies at Lake Superior. Wow.
Yes.
They bite.
Exactly.
They bite hard.
Yeah.
They hurt. Well, we have a commercial for that book, Finding Myself Again. And we like to roll that. Before we do that real quick, over on Twitter, we got a message from Ronnie Deshay. She says, hi, Beam, Stephen, and Verwaine. I'm so glad I could tune in tonight. Verwaine couldn't miss your episode. And then she sends her hugs.
And tell her I appreciate that.
Hi, Ronnie.
Period.
So glad to have you back in the listening audience. And
now
we're going to go ahead and roll that commercial. Do you want to say something, Stephen?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
A lonely man finds love again. After 47 years of a great relationship, courtship, and marriage, the author found himself alone. His wife had struggled with a rough fight with dementia. She took a sudden and unexpected turn for the worse, leaving him alone for the first time in his adult life. He was 64 at the time, but felt more like he was 40 physically and 95 emotionally. For over a year, he had tried to go forward with his life, but when he was alone at night, his heart's emptiness reminded him that he needed someone to fill the ache inside. Loneliness is a killer, and he was dying from grief. He was dying inside because he had never been alone in his life. He told himself that he would be all right, but he wasn't, and he was fading fast. Then he found Heather. They were two souls drifting in a sea of loneliness and grief that found one another amid a building storm. Is she the one that can pull him out of an escalating depression? We'll see. Finding Myself Again is a sequel to Verwaine Greeno's book, I Remember Judy. Readers are posting comments like this. Finding myself again was like receiving a sign so I can move forward with my life. Second chances are not to be missed. Keep searching and find yourself again. And I literally cried with joy for Wayne and cried with new insight for my future and know that I can love again. Thank you for writing this book and sharing it with us. Finding Myself Again and I Remember Judy by Wayne Greeno are available in paperback and audiobook from Amazon.com.
All right. So there you go. That's as you just said there, it's available at Amazon. So go over there and grab yourself a copy.
There's a video that goes along with this that we just finished making a couple hours ago and barely got uploaded to YouTube just before this show. So if you go to the Fresh Ink Group channel, you can find the Finding Myself video there and be one of the first people to like it. Or if you subscribe, you could put us over 100 since we're hovering at 99 right now.
Yeah, that's like he said, we finished it just before coming on the air. So, I mean, I was busy at work trying to get the show prepared and putting this video together. And wow.
Do you want to take it, gentlemen?
Do you want to go ahead and take that call before we get back to Verwayne?
Sure. Yeah, we're going to go ahead and take this call then. So, hello, caller. What's your name and where are you calling from?
My name's Tammy Trover, and I'm calling from Seattle, Washington.
Hi, Tammy.
Long time no hear.
Hi, how are you?
After
good.
All those years in Colorado, you've moved out to Washington.
30 years in Colorado, and I moved out to Washington near my family. Well, part of my family. I have a daughter out here.
Oh, good. So thanks for calling in. You have a question or comment for Verwayne?
Actually, listening to his story made me think about another gentleman I spoke with this week that lost his wife to cancer not too long ago. And as he started to speak with me, I know many of you know I'm a stage 3 cancer survivor. We started to talk about the grief that he went through and all the stages of grief he went through. And I realized that a survivor like myself, we go through those same stages of grief. And it was easy for me to fall into the same loneliness that he felt with losing his wife, with surviving. I felt very lonely after I survived. My husband actually passed away. He got hit by lightning not too long after got done chemo, probably about 5 years. So it's very difficult. But thinking about dementia too, did you find that at that time, even though your wife was still there, it's hard? I know I've heard how hard it is that time. And people, I don't know if you wrote about that in your book. I'm actually going to go on and purchase one of your books. But people tell me all the time, and I've worked with dementia patients, that's very difficult because even though they're there, they're not really there. Did you find that a very difficult time in your life?
Exactly. My wife had what they call moments of clarity. We would go 2-3 days and she would not really know who I was, where I was, where she was. But she would have these hours, sometimes a day, of clarity where we would talk about things. And she told me everything that she wanted me to do, and she apologized over and over and over about the way that she would say things to me. And she says, I don't mean that. And she, one of the few things in life I regret with my wife is I used to have her watch boxing with me on HBO and Showtime, because one day she had no clue what she was doing, and she got mad at me for something, and she clocked me with a right hand, right hook that gave me a black eye for over a week. And but she didn't mean any of that, and I knew that. Like I said, I worked, I was a paramedic. I was one of Michigan's very first paramedics back in '73,
And I've been around people with dementia as patients and as relatives. My mother died of dementia. Yes, they don't know what's going on. In fact, I'm writing multiple books right now, but I've got another book out that talks about grief. It's called Who Cares for the Caregiver When the Caregiver Hits Rock Bottom.
Wow.
And I'm talking about how to handle grief, how to handle everything that comes up. And I've got the cover design for it, but I'm not quite done with it. It's at about 34,000 words right now.
Wow.
And,
wow.
Because
it's still
very difficult. Even now, it's still very difficult for me to handle when I begin to think about certain things. It still breaks me up. And I'm having, you know, but fortunately, I got lucky. I found another woman who was just as soft, and you wouldn't think it sometimes the way she talks to me, but she's listening upstairs. She'll beat me for this later, but she's a lovely girl. You'd have to.
Sherry,
she's younger,
you that,
than I am, and she's faster.
I think he might be the gentleman I was speaking of. It might help him to hear you, because I think part of what he's going through is what you're going through is that he can't. It's hard for him to let go. It's hard for him to work. He said, I haven't worked my way through the grieving process, and it's been 4 years. So
wow. Okay. Now, as a medical, I don't want to say a medical provider, but I was a paramedic and a nurse for a grand total of like 39 years. Grief happens, and it carries on. Some people will have a grieving period of 3-4 months, and then they're good. And there are other people where grief will carry on a lifetime.
Yeah, I think
it depends on when they're ready to let themselves go.
Yeah, yeah. And he actually said, though, that he hasn't allowed himself to talk to anybody about it, because if he talked to his children, they'd be sad. So
right.
He opened up. I actually worked with him, and he opened up, and I think it didn't just help him. It helped me.
Good.
So I'd like to definitely play your show for him to know, let him know he's not alone, that there are other men out there that have lost their wives, you know, that are going
right.
through what he's going through.
Yeah, and you can point him to the book. You can point him to the book as well, Finding Myself Again.
And that process of trying to protect others, that makes you even more lonesome. You feel alone because you can't even share what you're feeling with others.
Exactly. Now, in the self-promotion business, Finding Myself Again is in the process of being an Audible book. And the guy sent me the first 18 minutes of that book. And like I said, it's been over 2 years, 2.5, 3 years now. And just listening to this gentleman read what I had written about the day leading up to her death, absolutely, I couldn't take it. I had to go sit down. I had to go lay down because it reminded me of all these things. But this gentleman that's doing this has a great voice for what I want, and his wife is going to provide the voice of the woman who is now my second wife. So. And,
that sounds terrific.
It takes grief. Grief never goes away. You will always remember that wound. But like, you got to remind him that just like a wound, you can get sliced open. You can have surgery, and for weeks and weeks, it'll be a big, gaping, wide, ugly-looking wound. But after time, that wound begins to fade away, and it becomes just a faint scar. And grief will still be there, but it will be just... It will be like a scar that's gone away. Surgery you had 10 years ago. It takes time to get there.
For me, I'm finding that it's over time. You get better and better at deciding whether or not you're going to deal with it right now or just put it off till later when you're feeling
yes.
it.
Yes.
Yes, that's true.
So thanks for calling. I feel for your friend. I wish him my best.
I will tell him that, and I appreciate you talking to me. And I did look for a land up in the UP at one time. It's beautiful up there.
Oh, it is.
It is. We call it God's country.
Yeah.
And it's definitely God's country. It's really pretty. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Tammy.
Well, thank you, Tammy.
Thank you for calling, Tammy.
Thanks.
So, Verwayne, you mentioned that you've various roles that you've had. You retired from being a shift supervisor in an ER. You've worked in a psych ward at a prison. You've even had a bit of a crisis happen while you were working at the prison. Can you tell us about that?
Oh yes, that whole story. I got my skull fractured.
Oh.
I worked in the psych ward there, and I came in one morning, and we had the place was still locked down because we had one gentleman who was not where he was supposed to be for count, and they asked me to go talk to him because. Was the way this job came about, they were hiring, but the warden, who was a friend of my dad, said, I hire 10 people. He says, I need to hire 10 people. 9 of these people need to be muscle. He said, do you lift weight? I said, no. He says, so you understand why I hired you. Basically, he hired me to be able to talk to people, to communicate back and forth. And they would set me into areas to gentlemen who had locked themselves away. In prison, your cell is called a house. These guys would go into their house, and they wouldn't come out. They wouldn't socialize with anybody. And they would sit in there and deteriorate and rot. Even a guy doing life doesn't need to be deteriorating and rotting. So that was my job, was to bring these gentlemen out. I had to talk to this guy, and he's now dead, so I can talk about this. I went out there and I talked to him and I said, hey, what's going on? He says, Jimmy Carter was on TV last night and he said that, he was giving me a full pardon. Well, the only problem with that was Reagan was president at the time. Well, I talked him in, I assured him that if there had been a pardon issued that I would take care of it. And I said, have I ever lied to you before? And he said, no. So I got him back to his house. That was a 45-minute ordeal talking to this guy. This guy is like 6'7", weighed about 300 pounds, and he had a fist that made Muhammad Ali look like a baby. And I got him all locked in. I went down, took my break, and they come back, and they said, hey, Greenho, they want you to come down here because they're going to let him out for him to go talk to the doctor. This doctor was brand new. He didn't understand prison talk. He didn't understand prison slang. And when this guy went to talk to him, felted him, and I knew right away life was going to get tough. And he picked my partner up, threw him. You've seen those glass windows that's got the wires in crisscross between them?
Yeah.
He picked my partner up and threw him head first through that window.
Wow.
And I tackled him with every thought of, this is not going to work. But then he caught me and brought his left elbow right back straight in the middle of my face, and he fractured my skull, and I lost about a cup and a half of spinal fluid.
Oh.
Well, long story short, I went down the tube big time. I spent 6 weeks at Blodgett Hospital there in Grand Rapids in the neuro ward. But then I began to have other problems. And all that's laid out in a book that's called My Long Road Back. Because at that point in time, they had absolutely no idea the effects of, everybody knew about closed head injuries and post-traumatic stress syndrome, but they didn't understand it. Well, I got the crap beat out of me, and I began to float off. I don't know why my first wife ever stayed with me. I never struck her. I never hurt her physically. But God knows I hurt that woman something terrible emotionally. And I went to the dentist. And when I woke up 4 hours later, there was a Michigan State Trooper knocking on the side of my car window. And he said, son? I said, yes. He says, do you know who you are? And I told him. He said, do you know where you are? I had no clue. Turns out I was just outside of Ludington. And I was sitting there listening to country western music, which I hate, and eating a bologna sandwich. I was eating raw bologna sandwiches with a loaf of bread and a bottle of ketchup that I had gotten. Well, they ended up following, the state police followed me all the way home. And, but that was, that built, that whole story just built and built and built and built until it just absolutely exploded some 3 years later. And it's a short story, but it's called My Long Road Back. And if you see, if, I don't know if you remember the show ER, but see, everybody thought I was always faking that crap. And then after Dr. Green, Mark Green, got beat up there in the bathroom.
Anthony Edwards.
Anthony Edwards. They begin to talk about the after effects of skull fractures. Well, and it affects everybody differently. And I had massive headaches for years. And that book was probably the hardest book I've ever written. And because I started it, I originally wrote that in 1989. I wrote it again in 94. I wrote it again in 98. I rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it. Every time I wrote it, I added more. And every single time that I wrote it, rewrote it, I got a headache and I began to have bad dreams. And I think I finally got all that behind me. But that was a true story. Every bit of that was true.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. Let me just inject here. Listeners, we are speaking with author Verwaine Greenhoe. And if you would have a question or a comment, you can call in at 516-453-9902. That is area code 516-453-9902. And what I find completely fascinating, Verwaine, is how you went from being, this guy that's basically battling an inmate in a cage match, but having that kind of a background in the prison and having to deal with violent criminals like that. But you've also done something that I find just truly fascinating. That is, you tried your hand at stand-up comedy. Tell us a little bit about that interesting aspect.
Well, I've always considered myself pretty on my toes, and you say something and I can have a good comeback for it. Well, my wife was a traveling nurse for 10 years, and we were in just outside of Tampa. And they had, I can't remember if it was called the Giggle Factory or something like that, over there to Tampa. And I always had wanted to try. So they had a mic night. So I did probably 10 or 12 things there at the Giggle Factory or whatever it was at that point in time. And then all of a sudden, my wife got sent to San Francisco. Well, everybody knows San Fran is the home of a lot of comedy shows or comedy places.
A lot.
I went to the Improv, was just down the way from me. So I went to the Improv and I watched what they were doing. And finally they had open mic night and I tried. Well, I didn't get in the first time. Well, the second time I went, they got in there and nobody said anything to me. And you did a 3-minute gig and you were there and you had to be able to read your audience. Because if a comedy thing ain't going right, it ain't going to go right. And you might as well grab a Coke and sit down because they'll start throwing crap at you here pretty quick. Well, the second time I went in and tried it, they told me, he said, you're funny. I can't tell you exactly what he said, but he said, you're pretty funny. But I was scheduled to go back and get a 5-minute gig where I would get paid on amateur night. And then my wife got a sudden shift out of there and we went from San Francisco all the way back down to Sebring, Florida. So I missed that.
Well, from comedy to writing. So how many books do you have out now, and how are you publishing those?
Well, I have about 30 or more up on Amazon. Wow. I self-publishing them. I'm going back through, as you're aware, I wrote a book here. It's called, there are plotters and pantsers. Most people are plotters.
I'm a plotter.
I can't do that crap.
I'm a plotter.
I can't do that crap. I pants it. And so I wrote a short story. It's only 11,500 words, but it's called So You Want to Be a Pantser.
And that's available on Amazon.
Amen. but basically, you got to remember a lot of this from 2014 to 2018, I was losing my wife. And a lot of crap that I wrote was good, but it wasn't polished. Well, I accidentally come up with this thing I call my G&G self-editing thing. And I'm not going to tell you it will catch everything, but by gosh, it catches 99% of the problem. So, and I think Mary Adler was the one. She did me with Daddy Has Cancer. And she told me, she says, you have this problem where you write these big, long, complex statements. She says, you can't do that. Mary was very nice. I began to see that, and it took me quite a little while how to avoid that and how to fix that, because that's not easy to fix without completely changing everything that you did. But my G&G method has helped me clean up a lot of my stuff. Absolutely. So, I spell it out. I tell you how I write, chapter by chapter, and how I work my motion up. You know, you got to go up a step, or how I write the story is, it's like going up a big long stairway. You go up, you go just above the next step, and then set it down. The next chapter, you pick it up, you go up above the next step, and then let it down. And you got to keep doing that, because you can't. I can't remember the woman's name, but everybody thought she was always such a wonderful writer from the 40s. And she was horrible, in my opinion, because she would write a 205-page novel and not introduce the bad guy until page 201. That's not writing. Uh-huh. That's crap in my book. But anyway, I explain how I approach everything. And as I always tell them, your mileage may vary.
Well,
that should be out as Audible here really quick. So
on Amazon, we will look for that. Obviously, we can't ask you about all of your books, but we jotted down a couple of titles here. We'd like to hear a couple of minutes about if we can. Starting with The Murders on Staines Road, which I understand is something that happened in Montcalm County, right there in Michigan.
Well, it's based on something that happened in Montcalm County, which is where I was born and raised. I grew up in a little town called Sheridan. If you were from the town, it was pronounced Sheridan. Everybody else is Sheridan, named after General Sheridan from the Civil War. That was about a guy who had accidentally got out of prison. He was scheduled for life with no parole, and he somehow slipped through the thing and he got out, and he got paroled out to his uncle, who was having his own little case of dementia, and he went on and he began to have other issues, and he kept bugging the guy who got out of prison, and the next thing you know, he killed his uncle. Well, then he began to, some people kill one person and they regret it. Some people will kill and it whets an appetite, and that's what this guy was. It whetted an appetite, and he began to go after people that had the misfortune of running into him. And
so this is true crime, like in the nature of an Anne Rice book.
Yes, basically it was more like Truman Capote, the guy who
not Anne Rice,
a fictionalized true story.
Man Rule, I meant.
Roman,
yes.
LeCliff. Yeah. Roman LeCliff, I think it's called. A True Story.
Yeah, because if Anne Rice is writing true crimes, I'm worried.
Yeah, me. I have to look out the window.
She did
vampire
stuff, as I remember.
Yeah.
Now, you also wrote a book dealing with your skull fracture called My Road Back, Long Road Back.
That's the one we talked about earlier.
Okay. That's what I thought. Tell us about The Touch.
The Touch was about 3 years of my life as a paramedic. And with the exception of virtually everything I write about has been true, not always all at the same time, but with the exception of the very ending of that book, every little bit about that was true. I was a paramedic, but the story starts back in 1962. I was staying with my aunt, who was a very church-going woman, and she told me, I woke up one day and I told her, I says, I talked to an angel last night. And she says, you did? And I said, yeah. And says, the angel told me that God had something he wanted me to do, and then until I did it, God would take care of me. Well, then we begin to fast forward until my character was coming out of high school, and you will read there where I talk about I had a chance. I'd been accepted into, like I said, University of Michigan Medical School, and I ended up giving that up to be a paramedic.
Wow.
And things began to happen. Well, I ran into a woman that they called Crystal Annie, because she was from a small town named Chris, but she was allegedly a psychic, and she was a lot like that guy who did all those psychic things. You know, I'm sitting here and I'm getting a female's name who starts with a B, with a B, and somebody, my name's Barbara. Yes, it was Barbara.
Yeah. It always cracked me up.
Jonathan Edwards.
What he did.
Yeah, Jonathan Edwards. But anyway, long story short, we begin to continue on this thing. But she did all these girls. But I kept hearing the rustling around the curtains that were going on there. They were listening to these girls chatter. Well, basically what happened was she talked to them. And then I didn't want to do anything because she pushed this bowl in your face. And basically you're supposed to drop a few bucks into that bowl because she couldn't charge you for that back then. And I didn't want to give my money away I wanted to give my money to the crooks. I'd give it to the government. So I kept my money, but they said, well, come on, we'll pay for it. And she says, no, she took my hand and I saw her look at me. And she says, and she told me, she says, there's something in you. And she says, and you know it. Well, I don't want to say I'm a psychic, but I am an empath. I see all these girls. On Facebook, there's a thing about I am an empath or something like that. And it's a, forgive me, ladies, I'm going to say basically it's a bunch of teenage girls with menstrual cramps. That's the entire that's the entire group. You're going, what do you look at me and tell me what you see? I see a lot of things, but an empath ain't one of them because you can't tell an empath by looking at them. But long story short, the whole thing goes on and it describes, we begin to get we had an incident. Okay. We had an incident. My partner and I called it the deal in the ditch, where we got a call to go to a kid who wasn't breathing on an April Sunday morning in this ditch out in front of a church. And I'm sitting there, and this kid wasn't breathing. He's had a heartbeat, but you can have a heartbeat without breathing, but you can't breathe without a heartbeat. And I was doing mouth-to-mouth on this kid, and nothing would – normally, the way the system is set up, 3 or 4 good hard breaths will restart this breathing cycle. It did not. And I kept working on it, and all the church people were out there, and they're crowding around me, and I kept trying to push them back. Now, this is what people think I'm crazy. And all of a sudden, I had a man come up behind me, and he grabbed me by the right shoulder with his left hand, and I turned around to tell him to get back, and there was something in his face I knew. And I heard him praying, and he said to me, "Father, let him do this." And it was like I'd been defibrillated. Well, I give this kid his next two breaths, and all of a sudden he began, it's called Shane Stook, and they go, and I give him one more good breath, and he began to breathe. Well, I went back after that whole incident. There were a lot of other stuff that happened after that. I went back there to that church, and I asked the minister, "Who was that? Who was that that touched me?" And he says, "I didn't see anybody." I said, "No, come on." And he says, "I didn't see it." Well, all of a sudden it began to get out all over the county that I had done all this miracle stuff. And this is a true story. And we began to get these people who come to see us because I heard this. My partner and I going, okay, we will talk to these people. And we were talking to 3, 4, 5, 6 people a day because people are lonely. When you're lonely, you cannot survive. You've got to have human, hermits are crazy for a reason because they're hermits. But you've got to have somebody to talk to. And that's basically all these people needed. So we started talking to these people. Well, then my local newspaper, who I still won't read because of this, my local newspaper, they sent a woman there, and she says, "I hear that, you're claiming that you've been touched by God." And all this, I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." Well, anyway, long story short, she ended up publishing a stupid story about me, which about got me fired. But things went on from there. And it also builds to a real climax that was all true, but not necessarily the way that I told it. And I explained the difference in the epilogue.
Good.
But, that's a very good book, and it's a very good Audible book. The guy who did the Audible on that just absolutely nailed it. And it's cheap. It's only 2 hours.
I look forward to hearing that.
You may have a caller online who sent me an email.
Yeah, we do have a caller. Would you like to take that call?
Go for it.
I would love to.
All right. Hello, caller. Welcome to the show. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, thanks so much. This is Catherine, and I'm calling from Central Florida.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Catherine.
Hey.
Catherine.
Good to hear your
Catherine
voice.
Catherine is good. Yes. It's a little hoarse right now. Like I said, it was 29 degrees here. Catherine tried out to do – Catherine did an audition to do Finding Myself Again. But as soon as Lisa and I heard her voice, we're going, that's who I want. We both said, that's who we want to do this new book that we're writing on Used and Abused. It's the backstory to my wife, who was severely – physically, emotionally, and sexually abused in her years. And Catherine and my wife have been very, I don't want to say very tight, but they're scheming behind the thing there behind me. So I asked her to give you a call. What can you tell from what you've been? I'm like 25,000 words into the story, and I've been giving it to Catherine to begin to get an idea. What do you think so far, Catherine?
Well, it's interesting. I've been in touch with both you and your wife, and she and I have some girl talk on the side, and I ask her some clarifying questions because I want to really make sure I understand where she's coming from. Some of it I can relate to because some of it I've gone through myself, so I've been able to kind of reading through just even the rough draft, as it were, it's so insightful, but more importantly, it's extremely honest. And I feel like readers typically can tell when an author is just kind of fluffing things up, so to speak, like they just want to fill in the pages, right? Or they're not entirely being authentic in what they're presenting because they're going into it with an agenda. They want a specific view to be told. And what's so great about this book, Used and Abused, is it is so wholly honest that, you know, I had asked her, I said, how do you feel like you come across? What do you think readers are going to take away? And she had this view that perhaps they would think, this is kind of a stupid girl. Why would she allow this to keep happening? Which is very common with abuse victims. Most of us feel that way. Like, well, people are just going to think we're stupid because on the outside it does look kind of stupid. But, you know, so I asked her, I said, how do you feel people are going to take this? And she said, I think they're going to think, well, she's kind of dumb, but hey, she got there in the end. And I completely disagree. I think it speaks to the character of both of you that you are so open and honest and pure with the intentions that I think people, instead of kind of doing the, ugh, well, that's kind of rough to listen to or you know, read, what have you. I think actually that the compassion side is going to come through much more. And I think a better understanding of how women sort of end up in these cycles will be achieved much more so than a lot of these professional campaigns you see about domestic violence or whatnot. So, so far, and this is just the rough draft, so I'm really excited to see kind of how it evolves and shifts.
Lisa's had to sit down some days I'll write 5, 6, 7,000 words in that story. And then because she's telling it to me, I don't make this stuff up. I ask her, she tells it to me. And then I convert her words into the story. And then she comes in and she says, no, that's not what I told you, moron. Fix it.
Just like a wife. That's our job.
That's right.
Yep.
Just like a wife. But she will come in there and she'll tell me. And then, but we have nights where we sit and talk together about this because this shakes her confidence in herself and all this
yep.
stuff. And then she's always worried about you're going to hate me for what happened.
Yep.
And
yep.
I keep telling her what happened before was happened before. I have no say in any of that. So all I want is to hear, you know, the here and forever after this.
Yeah, it's the present that counts. The past, it's there. It can't be changed. There's nothing you can do about it. Nothing. And the future isn't
exactly.
here yet, and it's not promised to you. So what you're doing now, that's what's
exactly.
important.
Mm-hmm.
The ironic part of this is that I met Lisa in 2000. I was supervisor at the ER at the time, and she had to come in. She was taking her RN class, and she had to come in and spend a couple weeks. And she spent a couple weeks with me, and then she went and spent 2 weeks with my wife. You know, and then years later, we met again, and that was, you know, that's the it's basically you're getting the backstory of finding myself again, because
mm-hmm.
if you read that story, you will see that constantly there is a. She wants to do things that I'm not wanting to allow to happen, and she couldn't figure out why I didn't want those things. But it, to me, I could sense that she had issues, and I didn't want to push her. Never wanted to push her. So this is kind of cathartic for the both of us.
Yeah.
And, writing.
And I would say.
What's that, Beam?
I said writing does that. Writing helps to get things out and to, you know, or even just talking. It's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be writing, but I mean, even talking. I mean, it's like you said, cathartic.
Right. Well, like I said, Catherine had originally auditioned for Finding Myself Again, but as soon as I heard her voice, I'm going, no, I got a better story for you. So that's how we. Isn't that how? Didn't I tell you that, Catherine? I've got a
better. That yep.
I've got a better.
You, so you know.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for calling in, Catherine. We are going to listen to a short clip of that, finding myself again with the person that he liked better than you, Catherine.
Okay. So we're going to roll this. This is a sample from Finding Myself, and it was done just right before showtime while I was doing the video. I was working on this too, so it's about almost 3 minutes worth, so I'm not exactly sure the full content of it, but it's a good sample. It's a good idea of what the audiobook's about.
No matter how much you love someone, there comes a breaking point. You wish you could either walk away or hope that your loved one would just hurry up and die. You might not believe that you would say such a thing to or about the person you love, but you will. As the stress builds after 4 months of providing 24/7 care, answering the same damn question about who you are, cleaning up that person after they've soiled themselves for the fourth time that day, you will. That thought will come to mind and might even escape your lips. Of course, that thought brings the guilt of, how can I have ever said that? Fatigue, guilt, and feeling trapped fill your days, afternoons, and your nights. Day after day, after day, after day, until you think you can't take another day of it. You can't run to the store for just 10 minutes because your loved one might get into their drugs regardless of where you hide them. You can't go out with your friends because you can't find anyone to care for her. You can't take her with you because she might suddenly become paranoid and can't remember who she is. And worse, she can't remember who you are. She will raise a scene, crying and screaming, and probably will lose control of her bowels in public, all the while cursing like a sailor. She had never said words like that, but she was no longer in control of her self-restraint. If you're not expecting all of this, it will shock you, and you might decide to put your loved one in a home. This comment is not a knock against those institutions, but the sad fact is that most nursing homes, not all, are far too understaffed even to begin to provide the essential emotional care people need. It isn't the intention of the nursing staff, but is the reality of the situation. When a nurse aide is assigned 20 patients in an 8-hour shift, that is impossible to do. Take away an hour of that time for breaks, charting on the patient's status, and then shift change reports, an 8-hour shift leaves a bit over 6 hours for actual patient care. Even if you generously say the aide will have 7 hours dedicated to patients, that still means the aide has less than 21 minutes with the patient. In that time, they have changed their bed, helped them clean up for the day, helped them eat, cleaned up those meals, and got them dressed and or undressed for the day or night. There isn't any time to handle the social and emotional parts of life. It just isn't possible. I've known a lot of nursing home aides who have provided compassionate and loving care, but those people burn bright and then soon burn out. They spend so much of themselves, they collapse physically and emotionally. That was me. Totally devoid of emotions and strength. Unable to think, to care for me. I was running on empty. I was empty.
Okay, so that's a sample from Finding Myself Again, the audiobook by Verwaine Greenhow. Now
available on Amazon.
Available on Amazon. Now we're bumping up against the end of the show here, but I just wanted to point out. Okay, first of all, I'm reading the book. I'm currently reading the book, and hopefully, I'll have it done by the end of this week and get the review up. But this part in particular, talking about the being asked, now who are you again? That kind of thing. That's the mind of Alzheimer's. My grandmother had Alzheimer's. She died from it, and her sister, my great aunt, had it, and the great aunt became violent towards the end. And she was in a home, and they had to strap her down because she would bite and scratch at you, and she couldn't speak anymore. She was nonverbal, but right. I mean, she was animalistic almost. My grandmother never got to that point, but her mind was gone. She did not remember. I'd sit there and talk with her, and I'd be there for a couple of hours just chatting with her, and every 3, 4, 5 minutes, she's asking, now, who are you again? And I would remind her that, you know, I'm her grandson, and she would just kind of chuckle and say, no, you're not. Really, who are you? And, you know, that's a harsh situation. I couldn't see getting into the point what you just described in your book there. But I can understand that that's probably happens to a lot of people who are dealing with this, because Alzheimer's is maddening, not just for the person that has it.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, my upcoming book about who cares for the caregiver when the caregiver hits rock bottom or hits bottom at rock bottom. I go through all of that because unless you are a saint, it's difficult to keep those kind of people home. But I had made a promise to my wife that I would take care of her until I couldn't take care of her. And I kept my promise. You know, that's all that I want people to know is I kept my promise.
That's the most important thing of all.
Yeah.
We really appreciate you sharing all of these personal and private moments with us, Burr Wayne, and especially your readers for being able to read about them and find such poignancy in your descriptions and the empathy that comes from your words. It's very important.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Beam, we need to get this show wrapped up. We're over an hour already.
Yeah. Well, I allotted a little extra time just in case. But, yeah, definitely thank you for taking time out of your – Yeah. Well, we hope all of our guests like to talk. Now, Burr Wayne, you're going to want to go over to Twitter because I see Ronnie DeShay has left a few comments over here for you. I can read a couple of them while we still have a little bit of extra time.
Yes.
She says, things happen when they are meant to, a time and a place for everything, and I agree with that. And Ronnie says she's proud to be a Panther. And she also says, Burr Wayne, I bet you were a hoot doing stand-up. And there's a couple more there. Just you know how to do that, Burr Wayne, because you're usually out there in the Twitter audience. Hashtag Fresh In Group, and you can communicate with her. Yeah, definitely thank you for taking your time out of your night tonight and that cold weather up there and joining us.
Thank you very much, Burr Wayne. We enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you, gentlemen. And I appreciate everything you've done.
And listeners, remember, head on over to YouTube to the Fresh Ink Group channel, and you can see the new video trailer for his book, Finding Judy. And while you're there, maybe you could be our 100th subscriber, and make sure you like all the videos that you like.
Yeah, and if you enjoyed this show, this particular episode in particular, I just said particular twice.
Suddenly.
Go to the archive. You can go to the archive, and you can find the link. We're going to this out on Twitter, you know, in the following days here. And you can go to our YouTube channel. You can find it there. You can go to beamweeks.com, stephengees.com, and find it there and share it. Share the link to this on all of your social media and get the word out. And remember, tune in every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern time, and we're on live. So
next week, our guest will be author Larry Landgraf. Larry is a Fresh Ink Group member. He's the author of quite a variety of books, from dystopian thrillers, including a four-part series. He writes memoirs, nonfiction, and now he has a children's book out that's in English with a Spanish edition coming out sometime in the next week or so. We look forward to having Larry.
Yes, definitely.
Could I throw out one more quick thing?
Sure.
Sure.
I just wanted to say hello to my friends over to Blogit. Blogit.com. I've been a member there since 2002, and that's where virtually every one of my stories has been born, is on Blogit. It was posted there day by day by day by day. It's a paper.
Well, hello to Blogit.
But Blogit.com. Anna Sita and all my friends there, they're great people.
So, okay.
Thank you.
And while we're talking about stuff like that, we do have just a few more minutes here, a couple more minutes. Do you have a website that you want to promote, Burr Wayne?
I have one, but it's not quite back up. I had it, and I hate to say that it got hacked because I have 5 servers, and we pride ourselves on not getting hacked, but somehow that one did. Give me a few weeks to get it
Okay, well, how about this?
I'm in the middle of writing on two stories, but...
Okay, where can they find you on Twitter? Let's start with that.
At Verwaine Author.
Okay,
and
there you go, at Verwaine Author.
Cross between Vernon and Duane, so...
Okay. And thank you, callers, and to all those other Twitter hashtaggers for supporting the show tonight as well.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
All righty.
Thank you.
Next Wednesday, 8 p.m.
You've been a part of Voice of Indy, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.